From drawing to painting to silk screening and back to painting and then on to underwater photography. Stay tuned. Hello, this is the Ears on Art segment of Issues and Ideas, a program produced here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio, serving Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo, and southern Monterey counties on California's spectacular Central Coast. My name is Stephen DeLuque, and today's program is the first half of an interview co-host Krissa Hewitt conducted with local artist Dorothy Cutter. Dorothy has been a longtime resident of the Central Coast, and, like many artists, her path of artistic expression has taken her down several varied avenues. Our journey with Dorothy begins now.
Here in Dorothy Cutter's studio, good afternoon, Dorothy.
Good afternoon to you, too.
This is really a wonderful spot. How long ago did this get constructed for you?
Well, I had this built in 1969. So I've been here a long time.
Absolutely. So at that point, you were primarily doing painting and printmaking?
Yes. I had been working in a little tiny space with a card table in the middle, and it was about 18 by 10 feet wide, and the area was getting smaller and smaller because I had painting stacked up against the wall, and finally there was no room for me. In 1969 was the year I started selling a lot of work, and so I felt like I had the money and I could build something to house me and all my work. So I had this nice studio built, and within 3 months, it was somewhat obsolete. Because I had been so used to working in such a small space, when I had all the different racks built in here, I thought, oh boy, this is really something. But they filled up fast, and then I was back to stacking against the wall. So, yeah, you never can get enough space.
I think that is so true. If we go back to before this studio, when did art start for you?
It was kind of funny. I never actually did anything as a kid or in school. I lived in a big city. It was more of a tenement city, and we didn't have a lot of money in school districts, so art classes were not readily available. And so when I got married, one night I was sitting around, we'd only been married a couple of months, and I was looking for something to do, and so I started looking through some of my husband's stuff, and I found this old paint set that he'd gotten under the GI Bill. And I said, well, this looks interesting. Maybe I'll fool around with this. And this was my first time I ever did anything. I found a photograph by Diego Rivera, actually. It was the flower vendor. And I said, I think I'll copy this just for the fun. And I enjoyed it so much. It was like a whole world opened up for me. So the very next day, I went down to the Maryland Art Institute and enrolled in evening classes. And that was the start of 7 years going to art school. And that's how it all began. So you never know how different bends in the road will get you going. And that was it for me. And after that, I never quit.
When you were in the art school, what sorts of things were you studying?
Well, I started out with a very classical education, something that they don't do anymore in art school. At the Maryland Art Institute, the first year, you did nothing but draw casts. And I can tell you that I grew to hate that statue by Michelangelo of David, because we spent a whole year drawing an eye, an ear, the mouth, and the hand. Yeah, you got to be good at seeing, but you sure began to hate that statue. Second year, we did the whole statue. Now, our school's not like that. But it's not bad, you know, because it is good training. Learn how to see and to draw. Of course, nobody now needs to have to draw, so I don't know.
I had an instructor at Cal State Northridge who would tell us, I'd rather have you spend 2 hours on one section of your face than think that you can just draw the whole thing in 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Really explore, really try to look. I wasn't very good at it, but I certainly came to appreciate what he meant by that. Really,
well, that's true. Yeah, you do have to learn how to see, and it is something that stays with you for the rest of your life, because you do learn how to look and see little kind of details that you sometimes pass over.
So as you were working mm-hmm. on this very classical method of copying the master or masters, when did the use of color start to come in?
Well, I was very influenced by my last teacher that I had at California College of Arts and Crafts. It was David, suddenly I can't remember his name, Diebenkorn. So, of course, I was painting just like him, and I was doing these big figurative things. And then I sort of abandoned that and went into abstract. I guess I always liked color, and then I liked design. Well, I went from the figurative work that was very influenced by my teachers to deciding that that probably was not a good idea. I was never going to find my own way if I was always copying what somebody else was doing. And that is sort of what you do in art school. You try painting like Van Gogh and Matisse and so and so. But that is not the way to find your own path. So after my daughter was born, I found that I really couldn't work in all those kinds of things that I had been working with. I was using a lot of white lead in my painting, which is something that Diebenkorn used. And I thought, well, I can't do that. I gave that up when I was pregnant because that was not a good idea. And so I had to search around for a new way to work. One thing led to another. And then when my daughter was born, I decided to start painting my daughter. And I did that for a couple of years. I started painting her, and I'd put her in rooms and put her doing this and that around the house. And then finally she got a little big, and I decided to take her out of the rooms because she was dominating the scene. And then I just painted the rooms. And so I did that for a lot of years.
I'm curious as to your daughter's response to either A, being the subject, or B, eventually being taken out. Did she have any thoughts on any of that?
No, she never said anything. Of course, I had my son, too, who I wasn't painting. I did a few paintings of him. I don't know. They didn't seem to care very much one way or the other. I remember somebody once asking my daughter, what was she going to be when she grew up? Was she going to be a painter like her mother? And God, she made this terrible face and said, absolutely not. She said, do you know what my mother does all day long? She sits in her studio all day, all by herself. She said, that's not for me.
Has she changed any of her thought about what being an artist is, having grown up?
Well, actually, she is pretty creative, but she doesn't do any artwork. Yeah.
I'm not at all certain that I've ever seen work that had figures in it, so I'm more familiar with the empty rooms.
Well, one of the reasons you don't see them is that when I started selling my work in 1969, most of the paintings were of my daughter, and those were the ones I sold, all of those. So I have just a couple left that I saved, but so that's probably why you haven't seen them.
But I don't tend to think of you as a figurative artist, so.
Yeah, actually, when I was in school and in the years after school, that's all I did was draw figures. That's sort of what I did. But yeah, there's not much of that remains.
And you mentioned that you had come from Maryland to California, but we didn't quite get the story of how that happened.
Oh, well, okay. My husband was working in Maryland, and then he went back to school to get his PhD, and so then I went to school in Washington, D.C. I went to the Corcoran Museum School and worked during the day, of course. Then he got a job here in California, and I came out, and I went to California College of Arts and Crafts, and then that's how we got here to California, yeah. We have lived here in Morro Bay for 54 years.
I'm solidly in my third decade of being here and feeling as though I have some roots, but 50 plus is obviously quite impressive.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's been a mixture of, at least what I've seen, of painting and of printmaking, correct?
Yeah, well...
In the earlier years.
Yeah, well, I got interested in printmaking. I took some courses in silkscreen printing when I was in Arts and Crafts, and so I sort of continued that interest when I built my studio, although one of the things I regretted is I didn't build anything that would facilitate printmaking. I didn't have any place to wash screens, so I had to drag my screens up to the house to wash them. So, and then I didn't have any place, any racks built in, so I would string clotheslines and pin them up with clothespins. So it was really a mess in here when I was doing my printing. Because that influenced how big the addition was, because I didn't have any place to put them. So I think the largest addition I ever did was 100, and that was really pushing it. So.
Your work is very colorful. So when you were doing a print, how many registrations were you having to go through?
I did several, maybe 6 or 7, yeah. So... Boy, my back really felt it. So hard to pull those prints, especially if you're doing big ones. And then I got into doing really big ones. It looks silly in here with all those things hanging with clothespins. Yeah.
But if you're going to work that hard, you obviously can't afford to have them somehow start touching each other. Or
well, that's true. Yeah. I gave up printing because at some point, mainly because I just found it too difficult to pull the prints. I guess life always intrudes on all these things, you know. But in a way, it's good because you do what you can handle. I mean, I used to do huge paintings until I discovered that if I wanted to show them anywhere, I couldn't get them into a car. I'd have to rent a truck. And so... suddenly that becomes very limiting, you know. You sort of scale down, and you have to be practical about these things.
I can remember at some of the Mission Plaza events that some of the people working in clay would envy people working in metal because our work was so much lighter that we could physically carry a couple of boxes of something as opposed to all the pounds of...
yeah,
that's clay, so...
that's true, yeah.
You are listening to Ears on Art, a segment of Issues and Ideas, a program produced at the studios of KCBX Public Radio in San Luis Obispo, California. Today's and next week's guest is an interview with Dorothy Cutter, a local artist from Morro Bay. Here is co-host Krissa Hewitt.
We have talked with some printmakers, but... primarily people doing etching. So silk screening is a new one here. So can you describe what that process is?
Well, actually, because I studied this in the 50s, the method used was touche and glue, because nobody uses that anymore, because it is not really a lot of fun, and it's very difficult, but that was what I knew how to do. And so that's what I did. I never did learn any other method.
Can you describe it?
Well, what you do is you glue in, you know, if I can even remember. Okay. What I did was sort of reverse. I would do a sort of a rough drawing, and then I would fill it in with glue. And then you would take the touche and you would put that over the whole thing. And then, one was water soluble and one was not. And so then you would take out one, and then what was left is what you would print. So you'd have to keep your mind straight, because otherwise you would get very confused about what you were erasing and what you weren't erasing. I know that there's much easier ways to do this now. I mean, much easier, but that was the only way I knew how to do it. So
you had one screen, and then each layer was created with an addition or removal.
Right, and then you would clean the whole thing and start over with the next color. And, of course, the way you would do it is you would line up your previous screen so that you would know where you were going to put your little shapes. And my stuff had a lot of shapes.
Boy, is that true.
It was interesting, and of course I made a lot of mistakes and have to start over. But sometimes you would incorporate your mistakes and they would add something. So, you know, it seems like a long time ago I did all that, and it makes me tired even thinking about it.
I was laughing with somebody the other day who was commenting about looking at some piece of their work and having that sense of, did I actually do this? And if so, how? So I'm sensing that maybe even as you look at these prints, that there's almost a whole nother world that was a part of.
Well, that's true. I wouldn't have the energy, and I wouldn't. It's just like if somebody else did it, because things you move on, your values move on, everything moves on. It's kind of sad in a way. And even if you wanted to go back and do it, I don't think you can imitate yourself. You can do it, but it loses something. It's like copying. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't have any life to it. I have moved so far away from that sort of stuff. Now I sit in a chair in front of a computer and edit photos, and I love it. It's so easy. I don't have to clean brushes. I don't have to lift heavy stuff. I don't have to bend over, you know, pulling screens. Oh, it's a joy, I'll tell you.
And we'll get to that part of your creative process in a bit. So from the silk screening, did you then start to focus primarily with painting? Or were they
back
and forth?
Well, the painting came first, and then I do the silk screen. I do back and forth, I would say. I had a lot of, in the early days, in the 70s and 80s, I was having a lot of shows, and so I was always busy sort of fulfilling my commitments. I'd have to have 30 or so paintings for a show, and I would sell all the paintings for the show, which was wonderful. But on the other hand, then I had, when are you going to bring us some more paintings? And so it was like never ending. After a while, after 20 years or so of that, it got a little old. It was very exciting in the beginning, but...
You've mentioned that you had the privilege, and I would trust some kind of pleasure in being able to study with Diebenkorn.
Oh, yeah. Actually, he was a wonderful teacher, and he gave me an A, which was very nice. And I still have I have saved all my report cards that he signed with an A. Yeah. So maybe there'll be collector's items someday.
But when I think of your paintings, even though the color and everything is very rich and intense, there is a lot of detail there that I don't necessarily think of if I think of Diebenkorn. So other kinds of influences, or was this just come out of Dorothy Cutter?
Yeah, I really very consciously tried to wipe away all my influences and start fresh. And that's not easy to do.
You're right.
I found it difficult, but It's very necessary to do that if you're going to move on and find your own way.
Talk a little bit about if you can get back to that place, and maybe in some cases you're still in it as you keep exploring things, but what was that like in terms of sort of feeling like you were trying to explore new territory, or at least new territory for you?
Well, it was really starting over. I mean, it was very clumsy because you had to give up a lot of your skill. It's hard to explain exactly, but over the years you develop techniques, you know, you get very proficient at certain things, and you rely on that. But in some ways that's masking who you really are, and so you got to sort of get rid of all that, and you start out, you're like a child stumbling along, and what you do seems very infantile and clumsy, it isn't like you're starting out from scratch, because you're not. You do have a lot of background, and you eventually find something that I remember I did something which was very clumsy and awkward, but it had something. And I thought, you know, this is kind of interesting. I'm going to go follow this line. And I did, and that's what I did. And it's a far cry from what I ended up doing, but it was like a path. Mm-hmm. And then I just followed it along and to see where it would go. And I got more and more involved, and it sort of evolved. I don't even know if I can remember what some of the really early things looked like. But there are some of them around. Well, one of the things I did, the reason it's kind of hard to remember is that somewhere along the line, as I was working in that little tiny space that I had originally that was drowning me with big paintings, I said, you know, I can't take this anymore. I'm going to get rid of all of this stuff, because this was before anybody was at all interested in what I was doing. And I was just stacking them up. And so I took all the canvases, they were canvases at the time, took them all off the frames, cut them into strips, put them all in garbage, and took the frames and burnt the frames. And that those days we could still burn in the yard. So that was 78 paintings that I actually got rid of. And it was very liberating, because after that, I no longer felt like, oh, this little corner of the painting, I can't touch that because it's so wonderful. I'll work over here over on the right. And then I work over on the right and the left wasn't right. And I do that all the time. It was like things were too precious. I couldn't deal with that. Once I destroyed all those paintings, that was not a problem anymore. Boy, I could just smash in here and there. I didn't care. And that was probably the most liberating thing. The only regret I have is that I didn't at least take some photos of those paintings, because the few that survived were really pretty good. And so, anyhow, that's my story of...
Well, that's a really impressive one for me. I think that it is so easy to get wrapped up in our quote-unquote preciousness of things.
Yeah.
And that we don't see the forest for the trees pretty soon. And if I did it, somehow it has to be okay, and maybe better than okay. And often it isn't. Often it's just not there, or in your case, probably some very good things. But as you say, it wasn't quite you yet.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the message that I'm getting, that there was a Dorothy that hadn't surfaced.
Well, yeah, I think so. Yeah.
When I'm working in material that costs something, not that paint doesn't cost and canvas and all of those things, they add up fast. But it gets even harder sometimes to say, this is pretty ugly. I need to get rid of it. Or
yeah.
I've done 10 of these and I should have only done two. Or, you know, whatever the realization is. So that's impressive.
After I got out of school, then I was working on my own for about 10 years. It took me about 10 years to kind of evolve into something that I could say was my own painting. And then I started to sell my work, and I did that for about 20 years. And then I guess I got burnt out. Well, it didn't quite happen that way. What happened is I took up scuba diving, and I saw all that fabulous stuff down there, and I thought, well, I'll paint that. Well, I couldn't get it. There was no way to capture what I saw by painting it. And I've never seen anybody paint the underwater world. The only way you can get it is in photography. And so I decided to take up photography. And that was a real challenge because I had never I was not interested in photography. But I was determined to be able to capture that beautiful stuff I was seeing there. And so that's what happened. And once I got into photography, I sort of was ready to leave painting behind. So,
to our audience, next week we will be focusing on this wonderful underwater world that Dorothy has discovered. Our guest today on Ears on Art has been Dorothy Cutter of Morro Bay. A painter, a printmaker, and now a photographer, her decades of work have covered not only many different disciplines, but also different styles. To get a look at this, you might want to visit her website at www.dorothycutter.com. This coming Tuesday, February 12th at 7 p.m., Dorothy will be giving a lecture on her underwater photography. About her presentation, she says, "In a time when coral reefs are being destroyed and the animals that live there are disappearing, I would like to show photographs of some of these places that most people will never get to see. My photographs are from most of the oceans of the world and show the great diversity of patterns, forms, and colors that exist underwater." The event is free, 7 p.m., San Luis Obispo Museum of Art at 1010 Broad Street, a Tuesday night, February 12th. Dorothy and I will continue our conversation next week, and we'll focus, pardon the pun, on her photography.
Tonight, from 7 until 9 p.m., is the 2013 San Luis Obispo County Poetry Out Loud Competition. For those of you who have never attended, this is an exciting presentation of local high school students reciting poetry as part of a national competition. It takes place, as I said, from 7 until 9 o'clock tonight at the San Luis Coastal Adult School, 1500 Lizzie Street, in room J2. This is Stephen DeLuque, and you have been listening to Ears on Art, a segment of Issues and Ideas, produced here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio in San Luis Obispo, California. For co-host Krista Hewitt, thank you so very much for listening.